Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of Poulton Civilization Site.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-host...
Beatty.
A couple of housekeeping things here.
Housekeeping?
I didn't need that image. Thanks. Welcome to Polycast, episode 42. This is an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. My name is Daniel Quick, known as Dan Q on the forums, and I'm joined by Imran Siddiqui.
Hello.
Makalua.
Hello.
Cardamandua.
Hi.
And Beta.
Hello.
One day on the podcast, what we should do is, you know, when you introduce everyone, you should mix it up.
Yes.
So you say Imran Siddiqui, and Mackie says, hi. Makalua, and then I say hi, and then, like, that would be great.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, you'd probably do that anyway there, Imran. I'm surprised when I said Mackie, you didn't say hi.
I'll say hi to everyone. Hi.
Interesting bit of trivia is the fact that Beta and I live relatively close to each other.
Really?
Just down the road from each other, yes? Where exactly are you, Dan?
I'm just on before...
Wait, let me write this down.
Your man's going to sulky now.
As was asked in the last episode, where Kelly is, who goes by K-Madeline here on Poulton, and K-Mad Candy at CFC, unfortunately, we do not know her status. She has been unavailable for some time. We hope that she is doing well, and she will return shortly. But until then, Cardamandua, who guested on a previous episode this year and was also on the Christmas special that ended last season, will be our fourth regular. Welcome, Cardamandua. Thank you for agreeing to this.
Thank you.
You say that now.
I said it through gritted teeth.
In forum talk, why build farms at all, and why no building espionage in Civilization 4? Featured in the interview is Bruce Beta Hines speaking about the Civ 4 Beyond the Sword Democracy game about to get underway on a Poulton. The first of a two-parter includes the greater history of DGs in the community. Over in the research lab, the case for withdrawal equivalent for defense in the Civ series. Seated in the Senate is what is a reasonable gift request and a new top 10 list by request, unique units in Civ 4. Then in the mailbag, feedback aplenty from a Poulton's 2008 April Fool's joke, the launch of a third Polycast podcast.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
First topic is off of Civ Phonetics, and someone wanted to know, why build farms? Food?
Why not?
Big city? Maybe it's obvious to me and not them, I don't know.
It seems kind of silly that any improvement would be completely useless.
Well, there are workshops, I really hate... No, wait, never mind. Never mind.
No, he didn't.
Oh, he went there.
Farms give you +1 food with irrigation, and later on, +2 food with biology technology, not to mention the possibility of terrain bonuses. But as Jaded Parakeet, who started this thread, asks, he's a cottage person. But indeed, if you start off with farms, then you can grow your city to allow you to work more tiles, so then you can actually build cottages later on. I mean, I'm one of these people that do not change their farms over, but certainly if your city has grown to the point that you want it to grow and you're able to be using specialists, I think that's key to have specialists, then you can actually start working cottages later. You're not committed to farms from the beginning of the game to the end if you choose that. I guess I can also appreciate, although I do not use the slavery civic, I think it allows you to...
He's so moral.
He's Canadian, come on.
It does allow you to whip more, right? Because your cities are able to recover more quickly.
Yeah, it has a use.
Well, the other consideration, and particularly depending on the geography you're dealing with, quite often, if you're trying to put a city with a lot of mines together, the only way you're going to be able to support five or six mines is by having five or six farms sitting beside them to support that level of production. So it goes to something that I've never been that particularly good at, which, and yet they talk about it a lot in some of the strategy forums, is city specialization. And if the city's going to specialize in production as opposed to finance, then yeah, farms make great sense too.
Someone points out in the thread that if, for example, later on in the game, if you have Beyond the Sword and you found and start spreading Sid Sushi, maybe if you're not particularly interested in farms and you want to switch over to cottages later on, you could just do that, found and spread Sid Sushi. So that will supplement your food income and you can use your terrain for other purposes.
Assuming you get Sid Sushi, assuming you get that far in the game.
Don't die first.
Which I never do.
I had first-hand experience recently in the value of farms in a team pit boss game that's being played, and my teammate couldn't play, so I ended up having to take over playing his team as well. And when I took over the civilization, he was in last place, and looking at the reason for it, I could see that just there was very little emphasis placed on building farms or food production and just having a heck of a time trying to grow that civilization. So it actually meant I had to take some tiles apart, build farms on them to get the population up before the civilization could really start to work. So it was, to me, a pretty graphic evidence of, you know, why you have to balance into building a civilization.
Farms. Don't build your city without them.
If you ate today, thank a farmer.
If you're able to build a specialist, thank a farmer.
There you are.
You should put that in a field somewhere. Whoa, whoa. What about this, Dan? If you whip your thank a farmer.
Outstanding in your field.
Oh,
whoa. Oh. Oh, no.
Also here in the forum talk, in a different thread, Laanku, I hope I got that right, is asking, why can't we build espionage? We can build science, we can build culture, we can build money. Why can't we build espionage?
Good question. Calling all modders.
Well, I think it's because it's a skill, right? It's not actually a resource.
Yeah, but
there's also spies, so you can build spies, which in or a form of espionage where you don't have the same ability in science or hammers to do that. So in some respects, spies are the building espionage.
That's true, but why can't we not in our cities convert 100% of our production to espionage when we can do the same for gold, culture, and research? Was it just simply an oversight? Firaxis always intended that, but they had enough other things to do? Or was it on purpose?
Well, theoretically, if you have a city that's building gold, you have a lot of merchants. If you have a city that's building culture, you have a lot of, you know, artistry and stuff. But if you have a city building espionage, you're building spies. And then, well, I just think that a city full of spies sounds very unstable. But that's me.
You can abstract it.
Yeah.
And say, oh, they are doing it.
I always thought of the building stuff as, like, building stuff to get money to dedicate to that, like with culture. You're not really literally building little musical notes, you know. You're diverting your funds to support the local culture stuff. I thought of it as a funding thing, not necessarily a literally building a culture, you know.
Yeah.
So
I was espionage. You could be using stuff to help fund your espionage, you know, little slush funds, that kind of thing.
Exactly. The culture slider, I mean, it's like you're giving money to theater and you're endowing arts.
There you go.
In your empire. I mean, I don't necessarily think this is building much of anything. I mean, what would you exactly be building in culture-wise?
In espionage, it could be that Aston Martin with the machine guns in the front.
Hey!
And it could be a particular benefit, because if you have a really high production city, or even if you have a really low production city, I often find in the later game, if I have some later game cities that I'm building, they're usually in more marginal terrain, but I've got them there because, oh, I could use that additional crab resource for trade, for example, but it's not going to grow very much. And even in building factories and industrial parks and forges, the production really isn't going to be that high. So, hey, why don't I convert all the production that it does have to X to support, as I said, gold, culture, or research, Whereas with espionage, particularly if you haven't been keeping up with your espionage buildings, it could give you a bit of an advantage, or at least maybe not an advantage, but help you from falling too far behind.
Mm.
So that's a good question, Lanku, and we have good answers, but...
We haven't said any of them.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's about it. Welcome to an interview segment where we hold conversations with key individuals in the Civ community.
On the Poly Beyond the Sword team democracy game. Beta, pretend like we don't know anything about this, which would probably apply to Imran anyway, so it's not so far off.
Yep. What?
Not a problem. A team democracy game where more than one player is playing a civilization at a time, you've got the background to the team itself, but you also have the interplay with the other teams, and that's where human dynamics comes into play in a much bigger way than you can possibly imagine. My first introduction to Politan was through a team democracy game back in 2002. Got joined onto a team with John Miller, Eli, Whitlick, and Dissident, still good friends of mine here on the site. And we created Vox Controlla in the first multiplayer team democracy game with Civilization III. It was great fun. Not only did you learn a lot about Civ, you get to know members of the community. First example I had of where Civilization actually goes well beyond the game, Beyond the Sword team democracy game, which Rob Warham and Nugog are starting up. There's a whole forum dedicated to that game, and I invite those who are interested to visit that forum. It's getting close to getting started. Couple of key things about a democracy game of this nature, though, which is first, a lot of interest at the start. Everybody's keen. What civ are you going to pick? What traits do you want? What's the map going to look like? The challenge here is, as everybody knows with Civilization, which can be a long game, played in either format, is how you maintain that interest over time. There's some real key things to that. One, which is having great administration wrapped around the game so that when issues do come up, they can get dealt with quickly and fairly, as the case may be. And having a good host, particularly in a pit boss, is critical. That was one of the problems we had with the early Warlords pit boss game was the hosting issues. And Astrologic has taken over hosting that game, and kudos to him. He's done a fabulous job. It's been a very stable game since we've got it going, and that's, I think, has helped get that game back on track. I'm scheduled to be the host for the Beyond the Sword game. Hopefully I can be as reliable as Astrologic has been, and we can get that game underway. I myself right now probably involved in about 8 different pit boss games that are running on a 24-hour turn timer. So now you know where I spend my days. New folks are all welcome, and the site is more than willing to engage people in discussion about what the game is about, what's required. And what people have to understand is that they can the roles can be quite a range of roles, from team leader to team player to head of foreign affairs to teams always have lots of lurkers, people who can't commit to being there regularly, but will be there to put their input on key decisions or just to see how the game is played at that level. Team Democracy Game, it's been my passion on this site, and the one reason I love Apolliton is because it does support the Team Democracy Games so well.
You're the head of the Templars, I see.
Ah, yes, I am the head of the Templars, yes. And that's the other joy of Team Democracy Games, is that you can create some character around the team and do a bit of a mild role-playing or heavy role-playing, as the case may be. We as the Templars, we'd first decided that we wanted to be a heavily religiously oriented team, and Meadows, having finished the recent book, The Last Templar, had got us all enthused about being Templars again. We've all adopted the Maltese flag as the closest thing we'd come to a Templar flag from this collection there, and we're pretty pumped about the game and looking forward to getting underway.
Hallowed are the Ori? Oh, wait, that's something else.
Mr. Stargate.
Yeah. So are a lot of the makeups of these particular teams, have we seen them in previous democracy games on site? And people, if they are in one democracy game and they go to another, do they tend to stick to more or less the same teams? Or
that's an excellent question, and it sort of gets at the heart of this the question of team dynamics and the personal dynamics that can get created around it. As you may be aware, there was one of the three games, there was some quite hard feelings got created over issues of the way the game was played and accusations. And I think some of that could be because teams do tend to move on block from the people you're familiar with. You know, I played, I think, with ConMCB 25 now in umpteen different games, and to the point where I call him my brother and vice versa. So blocks of players do move from one team to the next, and so it's always good to see when people mix it up a bit and move to other teams. It's something I tried to do in the Pit Boss Warlord games, is start with a break from the folks I was playing with at Sorantium and try and start a new team, and just to get to know new people and try and kind of keep the dynamics from coming too cliquish. So yeah, people do move from one team to the next, but again, they're always accepting new members. I know the Templars has taken on a couple folks that are new to me, and I'm looking forward to working with them. Playing with them, I guess I should say. Civ has not worked.
Out of curiosity, the particular advantages and disadvantages of, say, a team member I see here, for example, Pal is at 6, whereas the Rabbits of C, because I'm not even going to try to pronounce that word, I heard 18. Is there optimal number, or is it really down to quality of the participants? And by quality, I mean those who are committed and dedicated and participating?
Excellent question, and I know Lacutus waded into that issue at the start of this game, saying that, you know, a team had to have some minimum number before it was viable, and I tend to disagree with that. I think you hit it on the head. It's a question is when you have and I wouldn't say it's quality players, but you have to have enough dedicated members, and I think even in some of the larger teams, you'll probably find that in there's a core of dedicated members. People keep the game going, who can be relied upon if the current team game player actually can't play for any reason. So to me, it's not a hard and fast rule in any way, and I can't say there's any benefit to a large team or a small team. Personally, I sometimes like small teams. I find them easier to coordinate. You don't have to convince as many people of a certain direction. On the other hand, they sometimes lack the dynamics and the fun of a larger team. Key being that they have a solid enough core. Even if it's a team of 3 or 4 or 5, there's a solid enough core of players who carry that team, then hats off to them.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
On the research lab, CFC, in 1984, has an idea for defense units called Escape. He wants a withdrawal chance for people on the defense in order to, I guess, an organized retreat type of option, where they would have a little withdrawal chance to, I guess, fight another day. It sounds like a good idea, but the interesting thing is that people point out that there had to be a lot of exceptions, because you wouldn't want your unit in a city to escape out of the city, because that would be dumb. And it seems like there would have to be a lot of exceptions built in. You might want certain units to just hold at all costs certain areas and whatnot.
If I have defensive units, and if I have them stacked in a city, I don't want them to escape. I want them to stay there and defend the city. I don't know, maybe add a line into there that if they're in a city, they don't, because they're defending the city. Don't escape.
Mm.
But to me, this is a chance to really expand the game, because you're quite right. And you said it hold at all costs. And I think to me, that's the key that, you know, in addition to putting fortify, maybe there's different levels of fortification. Hold at all costs, in which case, if you're in a city, you put them there and you say, you know, you fight to the last man slash woman. Or perhaps there's a more of a flexible defense where, yeah, if, you know, we're going to get beaten too badly here, better to run away and fight another day, in which case then the unit would withdraw. Some of that stuff is quite common in earlier board war games, and being able to accept that level of events, I think, would be a great addition to the game.
I do think the default should be to hold at all costs. Like, you know, you have fortify, the other option would be, you know, withdraw if you have a chance or something like that, because I think you want to prevent people who are forget or from having their units leave cities. Maybe if they want to have their units fight another day, maybe make that an option, fight another day, but the default is hold at all costs.
And you can see its use in a game. I mean, if you're fighting a two-front war and you want a sort of a slow retreating defense on one side, and to have units that have, and I think the thread was proposing that it's similar to withdrawal, you would get units that have enhanced escape. So you'd have these cities that are defended with units with enhanced escape. The idea being that by the enemy got his artillery and his bombers in place and that, you could withdraw from that city, let the city fall, and move back to the next line and sort of slowly grind the enemy down that way while hopefully winning on the other front. So I could see where strategically it would be a great addition to the game.
In the later post, Mech 1984 amended what he was calling this. He said, "I called this escape, but what I meant was rather a small tactical retreat, not a run for your lives escape," which in my opinion would add nothing to the game. So why didn't you modify your opening post accordingly? Tisk, tisk, tisk.
Even the running at all costs, right now with the way that the combat system works is that, you know, the unit stands and somebody wins or loses and takes the tile. And the more realistic version of combat would see, yeah, some units running for their lives and not being able to get their act together for another two turns. Some units doing a nice orderly withdrawal, some units fighting to the last person. So it's not unbelievable to me to see the combat system eventually could devolve into something along those lines.
Well, maybe I don't understand the whole thing completely right. Because from my understanding, when I go to war and I have my stack of troops, I'm the general. And I can say, you know, I want to attack this other enemy unit or whatever. Because it's turn-based, I say, let's go to battle today. And then if I want to keep going, the next turn I'll attack again. However, I also have that option to say, ooh, never mind. And I can physically move my unit two squares back. So in my head, it doesn't seem like it's a necessary addition that we're talking about. It seems like that we already play with strategy, right? Am I completely confused?
But if you have units in a city and you're about to be attacked and you're going to be attacked that turn, what you may want to do is to say, okay, fine, we want to hold them. If you pull back two, you're giving up the city right away. And I think what's being proposed here is some middle ground where you say, no, we will fight, we'll try and delay, try and wound the enemy attackers, but we're going to still let the city fall and not fight to the last man.
You do some damage before you fall back.
Yeah.
I don't know why you'd want to give up your city.
Game I'm playing right now with Snoopy, he relinquished the city to me because he realized he couldn't hold it, and if he tried to hold it, he was going to lose so many SAM infantry, so many bombers, the fighters that were there, so he just upped and pulled everything out of the city and pulled it back to the next level and on the chance that he could defend that better than he could. And it's going to take me and Banau probably another 6 to 8 turns before I can roll my troops up to that next city. He's doing it to buy himself time and save himself from losing probably 12, 15 units. Tactically, there's good reasons for doing it.
But you can pull your units out of the city, too, if you want to just give it up. You can move every unit out.
Yeah, that's what he did. He pulled all the units out, so I took the city. But I'm saying there may still be some value to be able to leave some units in there, saying the understanding that these folks are going to get their noses bloodied, but they're also going to hold up the attack for a little bit longer than just abandoning the city would have done.
Yeah, if there was this option to, you know, withdraw when you reach a certain level or whatever, perhaps it would take Beta maybe 10 turns or something to get everyone back to full strength where he could assault the next city, buying Snoopy even more time.
Exactly. Whereas this way here, everybody moved in, was unwounded, they're set to go. Let's keep the attack rolling as opposed to having to sit and heal.
It wouldn't be used a lot, but it'd be kind of a way to delay attack, kind of wound a little bit and pull back. I mean, not necessarily just in a city, of course. You could do it in the front line or whatever. It could be useful on some occasions. I mean, not necessarily all the time.
Yeah, I could see a Marine unit with City Defense 2 and Escape Option 2 or something like that being a really valuable unit. It would hang tight. It would probably take down a few attackers. And then eventually, at the end of the enemy's turn, would get forced out of the city. And then you could pull it back to the next line of defense and let it heal. Yeah, I like the idea.
But don't you do that anyway when you're playing your games?
No.
Do you need the computer to tell you?
Creating that middle option unit, and like say I had four of them sitting in there with two SAM infantry as my temporary defenders on the understanding that I'm going to lose the city, and it's stacked up against as a stack of 20 units. So yes, at the start of my turn, what I could do is pull the 6 units out and abandon the town, which in effect is what an example I just gave with combat with Snoopy is what Snoopy did. So then the enemy moves in on their next turn, undamaged and able to keep rolling. Where if he was forced to attack, he may have wounded 3 of my Marines, maybe killed one, but those 3 wounded Marines have an escape capability. They retreat 1 tile. My turn comes up. They pull back completely, but we have, at that point in time, wounded how many of that stack of 20 units?
Yeah, and killed a few or something.
And killed a few, no doubt, yes. And had their artillery, had to use their collateral capability, etc.
Okay.
At work, in relation to this, suggests, what if retreat was possible only to an adjacent tile occupied by units of the retreating civilization? And if retreat was possible and there were multiple tiles that had units of the retreating civilization as well, then the unit would always retreat to the one that was most heavily occupied. And if there were no adjacent tiles occupied by the retreating civ, then the unit cannot retreat and is destroyed. This rule would encourage the use of formations to support units with retreat options. I like the idea of the first part, that it would retreat to the tiles that are most heavily occupied, but just because no adjacent tiles were occupied by the retreating civ, then the unit could not retreat and is destroyed? Nah.
Nah.
Nah, I think you just shouldn't be able to retreat then. Then you just stay there. Then you just do a hold at all costs type of thing, because there's nowhere to go.
this is really getting back to good old days of board wargaming, and these are the kind of rules that were created for combat and war games of that era. Yeah, to me, it's a case of they treat to the tile that has the most friendly units, or to any empty tile after that would make sense. And it would make sense, it would be the empty tile that was furthest from enemy attackers would seem to make sense as well. In other words, you wouldn't retreat adjacent to the attacking stack.
Exactly, and in consideration of how far away it could get, of course, would be in relation to its movement as well.
Yep, good point. So a mech infantry could theoretically pull back quite far.
Exactly. Unless, of course, we're talking about, say, Civilization II, and all of the terrain is railroaded, in which case, well... They could retreat a long ways with them.
Or if they're fighting a spearman, they're pretty much toast.
Yeah, especially if that unit's a tank.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or a battleship, too.
That raises a real good point, which is naval warfare. So when a battleship attacks a destroyer, the logic of it is the destroyer is a faster unit. You think it should be able to turn and run, you know, when it sees something coming towards it. So, and yet that doesn't exist. The destroyer sits there and gets swamped by the battleship. So particularly in naval warfare, which is obviously much more fluid than land warfare, in reality, it would be a great addition. Naval warfare being more fluid. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
What is a reasonable gift request that came up on the Civ Fanatics thread?
Yeah. So in this one, Krill asks that very important question, how does one exploit asking for gifts?
I like fruit baskets myself.
Flowers and chocolates usually go a long way in the gift request, so.
Speaking of which, oh, Catherine asked for flowers and chocolates last game I played. And then she slapped me. That saucy woman.
And you enjoyed it.
Oh, dear.
Family show, but yes. No.
thought so.
I think this is a common sense question. Don't you just kind of feel for it? You know how far you can push your AI depending on how friendly you are or what's going on, or maybe you want to push them and start a war. I don't know.
The only thing I can ever remember asking an AI was to convert to my religion, and even then that was quite rare. That usually didn't go very well because, of course, they converted to my religion, then as soon as they could convert to something else, they did. About 50-50. Depends on the power relation and just how strong my religion was. But I don't ever remember asking the AI for anything else, even if they were pleased or friendly, just because the rejection hurts so much.
Don't say no.
I think it's because you don't want to appear weak, like you need to ask for their help. It's a complex.
There you go. I do like Sir Snuggle's responses, where I've demanded tribute 10 consecutive times from an AI just so I can get that, you know, minus 10, you're a real jerk Diplo bonus. Kind of ensures an eventual war. Yeah, I guess if you're bored.
Why not? You know.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking as well, and I can't think of too many occurrences where I've used it either. I mean, if you're that much stronger than the civs you're friendly with, you probably don't need anything from them tech-wise or unit-wise. And you're quite right, the only time I can remember using it is a precursor to war. Keep asking them until they got a good reason to go.
Yeah, you can drain their treasury and then fight them. Well, depending.
The reverse isn't true. I mean, I've had any instances where the AI have asked you for things, and depending on the situation, it's better to give it to them than risk war on another front.
Mm.
And I didn't think their request was all that reasonable, but I went along with it.
Mm-hmm. So don't fight me.
It was more than a fruit basket they were asking for.
Oh.
Never give up a fruit basket.
Yeah, they wanted to know how to make a fruit basket.
No.
Whoa, hey, I'm not enabling you.
Oh my gosh. Underwater basket weaving is a very fine skill of my highest artisans. I do not give that secret away.
So you are confirming that you do have that technology. Good to know.
I mean, I can't say. It's a state secret.
Oh.
Oh.
But we could ask for it.
It's going to be marked in red when you ask, so you can't actually ask. You know.
Uh-oh.
Is that because you don't want to trade it yet, or you just don't like me enough?
Both.
Top 10 unique units.
Ironic Buddha asked, since we had done top 10 lists on Wonders, leaders, and leader traits, wondered if we could do a Beyond the Sword unique unit top 10 list in the future. I had said that, well, perhaps we'll do such a list on all Civ 4 unique units, including Beyond the Sword. I do have a top 10. Obviously, it's been so long since we had a top 10. I was going through withdrawal.
Aww.
I was done step 9 of 10 on the 10-step recovery program, but I quit.
My initial comments stem from the demo gaming, where a lot of the team members do argue for a Civ based on the unique unit, and I just have never found that in itself was enough to sway the decision one way or the other. I also find that a lot of folks want to diss the early unique unit, the Quechua and the Chariot, some of the others, and yet I generally would find those are the ones I'm fondest of, because I found at the early part of the game, including demo games, when things are at their most tender, shall we say, with other civilization, anything that gives you a military advantage early in the game, to me, is much more valuable than something that might give you a military advantage middle of the game or later in the game. So, do I have a top 10 list? Nope. So what's yours?
Coming in at number 10 is the Ethiopian unique unit, the Oromo Warrior, compared to what it replaces, which is the Musketeer. It is immune to first strikes, has a first strike of its own, and it has both the first and second drill promotions. Number 9 is the Russian unique unit, which is the Cossack, has a large advantage over other mounted units and cannon. It has plus 50% versus cannon, plus 50% versus mounted units, although it is true that when it's going up against other mounted units, apparently it has a 15 strength instead of 18, but still very worthwhile. Number 8 is the Khmer unique unit, which is the Ballista Elephant. Its major bonus against mounted units never goes to waste because it always targets mounted units in combat outside of cities first. Number 7 is the Persian unique unit, which is the Immortal. It has an archery advantage, which is not found with either the horse archer or knight, which is plus 50% versus archery units. Coming in at number 6 is the Bowman, which is the Babylonian unique unit. Has a bonus against melee units that you're not going to find with the archer, which it replaces. At the halfway point on the list is the Viking unique unit, which is the Berserker.
Berserker.
The reason that it's here is if you only have copper but no iron, that's no problem. So as we can see already, just I think by going from number 10 to number 5, as you were getting at Beta, a lot of people like to emphasize the later game unique units. But indeed, first of all, you need to be able to get there.
Exactly.
These earlier units can help you put yourself in a better position to be better in the later game, so cannot be ignored. Number 4 is the only naval unique unit that comes on this list, but that's the Dutch unique unit, which is the East Indiaman. It is second only to the transport as the best transport unit. It carries 4 units instead of 3. Bombardment ignores walls and castles. Coming in at number 3 is a unit that Beta actually mentioned, the Quechua unit, the Incan unique unit. Big bonus against archer units, plus 100%, and also starts with the combat promotion. Coming in at number 2 is, of course, the Roman unique unit, the Praetorian.
Hooray.
I was going to say, if this is not in your top 10 list, we're going to have to talk.
Big boost over swordsman here. And then finally, the number 1 unique unit in Civilization IV, taking into account Civ IV and the Warlords and Beyond the Sword expansion packs, the Indian Fast Worker. Its fast speed makes it worthy already, and if you happen to have a leader that has the expansive trait, it makes it supreme because you get an extra 25% work advantage out of them.
All right.
What I found interesting about going through that top 10 list is there wasn't a lot of boos and jeers and what the fuh and all that kind of stuff.
Well, there almost was until you got to Praetorian. I'm like, well, better be in there.
We were politely listening.
Oh.
In anxious anticipation.
I was reading other stuff, actually, but okay.
He's reading Yahoo Finance again.
You give me too much credit.
Oh, Prawn, is it?
Prawn! No, you don't read Prawn. Come on now.
Well, you use your eyes.
I'm a big fan of the Cossack, and I think I put in a comment in your list. I think I would have put the Cossack higher on the list. It sort of flies in the face of my earlier comment about earlier era units, but I often found the Cossack really powerful unit and can help sway the game at that point. The other ones that of note that aren't on the list, the War Chariot for Egypt, even though it's just a marginal improvement over the regular chariot, I find at that point in the game quite often it can be critical. It can help Egypt carry the war to the other civilizations. And the other Gallic Warrior, I find quite often can be useful for someone who's supposed to be aggressive in the early days. That'd be my two quick comments on the list. On that, I'm not going to disagree with it.
No, you need to disagree.
Well then, let me tell you. How about the Impi?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm? 100% versus mounted unit starts with mobility. Joy of it is it's a spear, but it has a 2 movement points. So it's kind of like combines an early mounted capability with a spear capability. I know in Civ 3, the Impi was all a dangerous unit. I got to be honest, I haven't played with Civ 4 yet.
I've had them a few times as random, but the thing is, while the mobility is good and everything, it can get you into trouble because I can just run over all these cities and then you sort of overrun, you know? Try to take over too many too fast, and then you find yourself going, oops.
Dope.
And you end up having to give away those gift baskets.
Yes, exactly.
I like the Holy Roman Empire's Launch Connect because it replaces the pikemen, and you get 100% versus mounted units and 100% versus melee units. And then it also upgrades to a rifleman or grenadier, and I just like it, and I kind of like the name.
Oh, there's only one problem with that card, Amanda, and you see, we're talking about unique units for civilizations and the Holy Roman Empire.
Don't start, Dan.
We could talk about the Byzantine Cataphract. I don't like to build knights a lot of the time, but this unit seems to make knights worthwhile. They're stronger than knights. They have good flank attacks.
And a very cool name.
True thing. I'm all about the names.
All right, so Ironic Buddha, we hope this list was up to your standards and worth the time it took you to post a suggestion. Yep.
There is a good way for competitive play and to have other people give you advice. That's the Apollyon University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Apollyon.net/forums.
Really? Wow. How could I figure that out from Apollyon University?
I don't know.
Sometimes I wonder.
Greetings from the mailbag, where we address listener questions and comments.
OTCast.
Psych.
That generated a lot of discussion and a lot of thread views, most of them positive, depending on your definition of positive. So.
Yeah, a lot of them were like, oh, we like this better than podcast.
Wait,
what? Probably why we shouldn't continue to do it. It's too strong of a competition.
I did listen to the OTCast, and I was very surprised, Dan, that you were able to get that much stuff out of the crap we said. We decided to do it, and then we were trying to get people to do it, and then I think we ended up with a decent amount of people, and I think having Ming and Ra in the same room actually helped things. And it made it a little bit more silly. But for some reason, just being me, I didn't really have anything prepared. So probably should have had a list of topics. But we just kind of went back and forth and weren't really sure what we're doing. So we kind of blabbered on for, what was it, like an hour and a half? And we were wondering how anyone would ever be able to do anything with it. And I realized it was going to be an April Fool's joke. So I suggested, perhaps this horribleness could be used to make people, be like, what the hell? This is going to be a regular podcast? This is ridiculous. But somehow Dan was able to get a decent amount of time out of it. I think it was like over 50 minutes or something. And you actually made us sound decent, and I was surprised.
Well, it is worth noting that the blooper reel was 3 times as long as a typical.
Yeah, it was very organized. When we were recording it, we were like, oh, crap, Then be like, I trusted you with one damn thing, and this is the crap you give me? What the hell's wrong with you? But to Dan's credit, he actually made it sound pretty decent. So props to Dan.
Well, thank you. I will say that it may seem a little strange with the topics. For example, with news, why do you have news 1 of 3, news 2 of 3? Why didn't you just have all the news together? The first part of that answer is because of how loosely we're defining these segments.
They have a vague similarity to each other, so we'll just lump them all together, yeah.
The other reason was that to try to keep a flow as much as possible, because there were references to things, for example, in what became News 2 of 3 that referenced some combination of Time Machine and then Forum Talk and Mailbag, and if I included that all at the beginning of news, then either people would have thought it was really bad editing or that someone was psychic or something and knew of conversations that were to come.
In the future.
The episode name, A Bit Chippy, actually comes from a phrase that a certain someone on the show itself said. Would you happen to know who that person is, Imran?
That sounds like Ming.
That was actually you.
Oh, crap. There was this one topic, if I'm not mistaken, where the entire thing was basically bleeped, which was amusing.
Part of that was when you were talking about that you are a moderator now, and so that you couldn't certain things. You're essentially quoting what...
Oh. Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, though, I did think that it was hard to get a good time was in Polycast, and I assume in Modcast, when we mention certain individuals, sometimes they're bleeped out. And we spent a lot of time mentioning a lot of individuals in the OT cast, but Dan left them in for the OT cast. I mean, I'm part of the joke or whatever, but, you know, certain individuals were, if I would say it right now, there would be a bleep on their name.
Well, that's just bringing the spirit of the OT forum into life. Right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, the thing about essentially this kind of laissez-faire attitude, like, we'll release an episode when we release an episode.
Yeah, go to hell. We'll do it when we want to.
That sounds appropriate.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at polycast@polton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show, Modcast,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.polton.net.
Sid Meier's Laundromat.
I definitely wanted to talk about that one. I thought that was well done. Sid Meier is famous for creating giant heaps of dirty clothes with the just one more load effect. So it's coming in 2009, and then in 2010 we can look forward to Sid Meier's Porta Potties. Just one more dump.
That sounds like a shitty idea, man.
Oh, he just had to go for the obvious joke.
Oh. You've been listening to episode 42 of Podcast, official podcast of Polton Civilization Site. I am Imran Siddiqui. Bye. I've been joined by Dan Kick. Daniel Quick.
You want to kick me? Hey.
Dan Kick. Kick Dan.
I'll kick you first. bye.
Makalua.
Bye.
Annalie. Known as Cardamandua on the forums.
See ya.
And we're joined by Beta.
Thank you for the invite.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm amazed you accepted. Well, no. No, we cannot hear you. Is your microphone currently on mute?
Do you have a microphone?
I'm here. Could you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, you can.
Yes. Click on the link that Imran has provided. Normally that's a bad idea, but it's okay.
I have no roads. My city is natural. Natural. What the hell?
Natural.
One last little clip, if I could, and then you can either toss it or keep it. Is that okay?
I'm sorry, can you say that again? I'm reading the chat.
Don't read anything we're writing. It's a personal conversation.
You get it from Imran, I think.
Half my age plus 7.
How do you get a negative number?
Record date?
April 12th, 2008.
Sound clips, copyright Civilization IV and the Warlords and Beyond the Sword expansion packs. Copyright 2008, a Polyton Civilization site at apolyton.net.